Let me say in the, hi, John, good to welcome you. We have just to share a little bit about who we are, where we're from, and how we look at the political arena. You might just share with us. We want to give you that benefit too. Not by way of discussion at this time, but are you coming as an office holder, a candidate, or a concerned citizen in terms of talking about the Christian in the political arena?
I'm a councilman in the city of Great Bend, Kansas. And we have had a very divisive and disruptive situation in our city. I see one of our citizens here. I don't know whether he made reference to it.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
Which is a vital concern to me now. We have an impasse currently between our mayor and our council. And we have a community which has divided to the point that real hatred is beginning to surface. The unrest and the turmoil since the general elections in April, which saw a substantial change in the council mayor composition, I fear can fragment the city. Now, I may be overstating the situation, but in my own analysis, I fear that we have a very volatile, critical situation in our city. And as one of two, three professing Christians on the council mayor form of government, I find myself opposed to the other two Christians diametrically. And the community, the Christian community, seems to be backing them and not
me. Okay. John, appreciate you sharing that very openly. We're going to have a little study in the book of Daniel, and then we will take some time to share some of these questions and concerns and see what maybe insights we can mutually find. That's a tough spot to be in, to say the very, very least. Why don't we open our Bibles at this point to the book of Daniel, Old Testament prophet. Most of us, I suppose, if we've had much to do with the Old Testament, or Daniel in particular, think of him more in terms of prophecy and the prophecy toward the future and all that, and may not have characterized him as a man in the political arena. Not thought of him that way. I think, though, it's important for us to look at a man as God looked at him, who was in, I believe, the political arena, to see what God might expect of someone in that context, and answers the question, I think, whether a Christian can be in the political arena or not, and secondly, what God will honor in terms of a Christian in the political arena, if he so calls him there. You notice the quotation from Proverbs here, which is on the handout I simply gave to you. When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. God indeed blesses, and the people rejoice when the righteous are in authority. And I guess we might say, in many places in our nation today, if not around the world, the righteous are not in authority. Now Daniel, as you may well know, a young boy when he was taken from his home in Judea, transported against his will by Nebuchadnezzar to Babylon, plucked down in a pagan society, which has got to be certainly as anti-God, or more so than ours is, pulled up, we'd think, from his parents and their influence, taken away from the institutions of his religion, in other words, external form, and put in a place where all the influences would be to conform him to that culture. When a Christian gets into the political arena, that's the kind of thing that certainly is happening. He's certainly out in the world. He's certainly in a situation where he might be conformed to that. He doesn't usually have influence of the other Christians or the community strongly supporting him in the spot where he is. Now, that was this man, Daniel, a young boy. And so as we maybe look at the first chapter here, look in the verses here starting with verse 8 of the first chapter. We make sure our Bible, if someone doesn't happen to have one, wants to look at it. Remembering where Daniel is, he's been brought here to serve the king. He may even at this point be a eunuch against his choice, because oftentimes that's what happened to servants that were going to serve the king and such. And he's under the chief eunuch, apparently. So, you know, in every way, it's almost like we'd think he's a prisoner of war, which in a way he was. This is his situation. And he's, of course, been provided for by the king as far as food, rich food and drink. And he's going to be educated for 3 years in the culture of the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, so he can serve the king in his court. But it says in verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's rich food or with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. Now, I think it's an interesting thing here because many of us have to, you know, begin to ask the question, what's our responsibility if we are in the political arena, and what do we expect of those that we've elected, maybe, or are elected as Christians? What do we expect of them? How do we expect them to act? I think it's interesting to note here, first of all, that Daniel was a holy man. He chose to obey his God. But secondly, I think it's important to note what he did. He attempted to work within the system of government that was over him. He didn't simply go to the eunuch and say, I won't eat that food. I refuse to do this. We don't know what he would have done. You know, the scripture doesn't give us that choice. What he did, though, he went to the eunuch and asked him. He worked through the channel that was there and said, because I don't want to dishonor my God, because I want to be a holy man, in effect, I cannot do this. Verse 9 gives us the response for what happened. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. Now, it goes along with Romans 13, if you're familiar with that, and this is in the material you have, which speaks in terms of how all authority is ordained under God and how we're to submit ourselves to that authority. And so I think this is an example where a man determined he'd be a holy man, he'd obey God, and he worked through the channels of government that were available to him, and God honored that, and he didn't have to defile himself. There is another proverb that says that the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, whithersoever he will, he turns it. And many times I've been able to use that and pray that in my own life when I have a circumstance or a situation. I'm under authority, and I believe this is the right thing to do. And as a judge, I'm under authority, and there are judges, there's an administrative judge over me that I answer to, but judges have a lot of clout in some ways, and I could simply, and I don't always do this perfectly, just say, well, I won't do that, and probably get away with it. But I really believe there's a principle here that we need to submit ourselves to those authorities over us. And I was amazed how in one circumstance, God has blessed me and protected me by my doing that with a judge above me, and other people try to give me difficulty, and he protects me. And I think that's God's vehicle of using to protect us. Well, again, I'm talking about a person that's in political life, and particularly that applies to John, but I think it gives us a sense of what we ought to, how we can encourage and what we ought to expect maybe of men in authority in terms of the political arena. So we have a holy obedience working within channels, and then I think that's evidenced over in chapter 6. Let's look at some of the characteristics of this man, Daniel. He's now under another king. The Medes and the Persians have taken over the Babylonians. And Darius is now in charge. And amazing enough, here is Daniel. We know that in the meantime, God's honored him and tells us in the last part of chapter 1 that he and those that followed him, those other Judean youths that followed him, had wisdom 10 times the wisdom of all the other counselors that the king had, that God gave that to them. And he's still here involved counseling under the Medes and the Persians, amazingly enough, when we come to chapter 6. And Daniel is one of the three under the king in charge over the whole kingdom. Then this tells us about Daniel's type of character Daniel had, verse 3. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps. Why? Because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. And I think verse 4 is interesting about Daniel. Then the presidents and the satraps, there was envy here, sought to find the ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. In other words, with regard to the way he handled the affairs of government, the way he was handling the everyday tasks that come up. I don't know what all his responsibilities were, but they must have been varied. This was a real nation. These were real people. There were real practical problems of rendering some kind of services to them and all, making those day-to-day decisions, ministering the government over this people. That's what Daniel was involved in. And they sought to find some fault in how he was doing this. And the amazing thing that the scripture tells us, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault. The New International Version says they couldn't find any corruption or any negligence on his part. Oh, for men like that in government. You know, I say that of myself. Listen, you know, I say, oh, Lord, that I'd be a man like that. But this is the circumstance of Daniel. He set his heart first to serve his God, to be a holy man, to obey his God, to submit to that government in that context. And God raised him up. But in the administration of kingdom affairs, they could find no fault because he was faithful and no error or fault was found in him. Well, we know, I'm familiar with the fact that these men tried then. They thought the only way we can find any difficulty with this man in the king's eyes is if we can get something about the law of his God, because they knew, that's the interesting thing, they knew he was going to obey the law of his God. Apparently his reputation was so clear that the God that Daniel followed, if it was a law of that God, Daniel was going to do it. He must have had a public reputation for following the law of his God. Because in verse 5 it says, then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. So they knew him pretty well, and he must have had a public witness to following this living God. So we know how they set it up, so that Daniel in a situation of having to cease to worship his God and in order to worship the king during his 30 days, because the decree goes out that the only person that can be worshipped, because none of these other gods, there were many gods that were worshipped in that day, none of these other gods could be worshipped except the king for these 30 days. Here comes the point when Daniel does not do what the king says. When it comes to the item of worshipping his God, verse 10 then tells us in chapter 6, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he knows what the law of the king is. In other words, he's clear about what his obedience is if he's to obey the king, the law. He went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem, and he got down upon his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God. as he had done previously. Now, Daniel didn't go out to set up a riot or set up a demonstration. Daniel simply continued to be the holy man he was. And in that day, it was proper and appropriate and ordained that you would worship and pray to your God in this way. So he set his heart on his God three times a day in his private chamber, as he'd done previously. And, of course, this set up the ground for his being charged in this context. So here we have him, holy man of God, set to obey the law of that land, had an excellent heart, no ground for complaint in his capacity as a public servant in the kingdom. He's faithful. There's no corruption, no negligence. And we have him up against the law now of the land. I think the king's response is amazing. It says a lot about Daniel's relationship to the king. Verse 14, when the king heard these words, he was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. The king was going to do everything he could to deliver Daniel from, of course, what the law had said was any man would be put to death who didn't worship the king. But he could find no way around this law. Verse 16, then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast in the den of lions. And the king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve, continually deliver you. And then down at verse 18, then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Now, this is a pagan king. This is a man who does not believe in the living God. No man who has his nation worship him believes in the living God. That's obvious, without anything else being said. But this king is so desirous of this righteous man Daniel being delivered that he can't even sleep tonight and does what he can. And we don't know. Maybe he cries out to Daniel's God during that time and asks, we think he might, Daniel's God deliver him. You know, we wonder what kind of relationship, it must have been a relationship of submission, a relationship of servanthood that Daniel had to the king. And that king must have not had any idea that Daniel was trying to take his place, take over his position of authority. Those are just some suspects that I have of that relationship. It says something about the man Daniel on how we might submit ourselves and serve in positions of authority. Because most of us, if we're in positions of authority, we're under someone else. Almost everyone is under someone. Even the president is under some authority, you see. And as we're going down this line, of course, what we're also doing is listing the characteristics of the kind of man we might want to search out for political office. That's another aspect of what we're saying here. Well, I love how the scripture gives us a synopsis on Daniel here. Of course, the king runs to the den in the morning and cries out to Daniel, wonders if his God has delivered him. And Daniel says, verse 22, my God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths, and they have no hurt for me, because I was found blameless before him, before God, and also before you, O king. I think that's interesting. Blameless before God and blameless before the king. I have done no wrong. The king then was exceedingly glad, commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den, so Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of hurt was found upon him because he trusted in his God. And then, of course, in the verses 25 through 28, I won't read them, but what we find is that God got the glory, and Daniel gave him the glory. And that's who Darius gives the glory to when Daniel's delivered. He doesn't say, oh, how great you are, Daniel, but he says, how great is the living God. And a decree goes out to protect anyone that worships Daniel's God. Daniel always gave God the credit. Verse 21, then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel. Verse 23, because he trusted in his God. Remember those, the influence he had on the Meshach and company? Back over, and I'll just read this to you. Verses, chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. These men who had decided they wouldn't again worship the idol, that was the same issue. And they were, of course, thrown into the fiery furnace, and they were delivered. And let's listen to their attitude. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer in this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. Heart was set on their God. Daniel always gave God the credit. When he interpreted the dream for Nebuchadnezzar, back in chapter 2, verses 27 and 28, he made it clear to the king before I ever said a word, it's the God of heaven, the living God, that's interpreting your dream, not me. Always gave God the credit. Always gave God the credit. So God blessed Daniel. And as I've already given you out of verse 9 of chapter 1, his favor in men's sight, 17 through 20, he was well-rounded and above all, 10 times the wisdom of all the rest. 16 through 18 of chapter 2, great secular knowledge, and others followed his leadership, and God got the glory out of all these circumstances. So I think maybe we can conclude several things just from looking at the life of Daniel. One, God may call men into the political arena to serve actively. And that could be at any level, or could be in a employment in a government position. Could be elected, appointed, could be in some other capacity. God may call a man into that arena, a pagan place, where after all we're called to be in the world. And so quite properly can be there. Secondly, it's the same there as any place else we are. We're called to be holy men, pure men. And that's the kind of men that God blesses. Daniel gives us an excellent character picture of the kind of man that God blesses. And I think some particular instruction about submission to authority. And it seems to me, along with Romans 13, verses 1 through 7, it talk about our relationship to government, that maybe that aspect of our hearts may need God's challenge and healing as much as anything in our day, because as we look about, Christians oftentimes, as well as non-Christians, are not submitting to the lawful governing authorities. If you remember, the Romans is written in the context of the Caesars and a corrupt and a bad government, and certainly a pagan, non-Christian environment. And it's hard for us to accept sometimes. But the truth of the matter, that's the context to which Paul wrote Romans 13 to these people living in the city of Rome. God's economy has put us under the authority of even pagan governments and given us special responsibility there. Now we tangle with the Nazi Germany kind of situation, and Daniel tangled with that obviously too. Where is the line drawn? But I have the sense that we err more on the side of not submitting to lawful authority and then counting on God. You see, that's what Daniel did. Daniel submitted himself to his God and left it to his God to deliver him. And I think that same principle works as citizens when we pray for, as we're admonished to by Paul, our leaders and such, for God to work, God to change them. I think it's just one aspect of God's economy, from relationship of husband and wife, relationship within a church body, submission to others, relationship out into the character of our government and the relationships there. Now we have about 20 minutes yet. And before we get into discussion, let me mention this book. I have not completely read it. George Fouché handed it to me 3 or 4 days ago, written by John Warren Johnson, who was a councilman in Minneapolis and also a state representative, served in an elective office for about 11 years. And he covers the groundwork from running for political office, campaigns, bribery, handling disagreements, right down the line. And so, and I've read enough of the material to believe that he is a man of God, and he's trying to give some, from his own experience, some very practical answers. He's got a lot more experience of that than I do. George Fouché knows him personally and highly commends the book. And so there are some here for sale. If anyone would want them, I can also give you a little brochure on it. I'm not promoting the book. I'm just saying it is one written by a Christian who's been there. And I think that's a helpful thing to have. There are several biographies, too, I would mention. You may have read them, but I've just been reading one of Harold Hughes, who has, of course, an alcoholic, arose to be governor, and then U.S. senator. And I've really been blessed by reading his book and his illustrations of being involved in very practical, nitty-gritty situations and some of the stands he took. Now, I don't know of Harold Hughes, really, apart from that book, but there are some examples like that are instructive to us. Now, let's see where we are, having shared a little bit out of Daniel and had some of your comments. What strikes you at this point from where you're sitting? And what question, if any, do you want to raise that maybe we'll have some interplay on?
The first thing that hit me was the fact that Daniel submitted himself to God, above the government, and he knew when to be submissive to God and when to disobey the government, or the government.
Mm-hmm.
He asked not to. He asked if he could not defile his body. That's a kind of a hard thing. When do we say, "No, I can't do these things," in such a secular environment?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a very, very challenging thing. I'm trying to think of some examples I personally had in that regard. I was first assigned as a judge, for instance, to the juvenile department of our court, and put under the authority of a man who's not a believer, a very hard man, and just required the letter of the law by everyone, and not always even deal with people in a loving, kind way at all. And it's kind of difficult to me. My first reaction, a lot of people were coming to me. We both went into this, and a lot of people began to come to me and obviously attempt to get me to take a different position or a different viewpoint, which, of course, would have caused division and disunity. And I believe that he was incorrect on some things. But as I prayed it through and all, my reaction in that circumstance was he was in authority over me, even though we had mutual jurisdiction, so to speak, and that kind of thing. Nevertheless, he was assigned to be in charge, and I was working with him in this department. So I refused to hear complaints. Or I might hear them out without really agreeing with them. And by continually attempted to encourage these people, if they had a legitimate complaint they felt, to go to him, appeal to him, present it to the one in authority that really had the authority to change things. I personally attempted to do the same thing, and I attempted to have my own influence when asked. The result of all that was I discovered that God blessed me, and the man never took issue with me, or if he did, he did it privately. And in public, if there were some problem or difficulty came up and I was attacked in some way, he stood up for me. It was amazing. And what I sensed, that God blessed him. And I also sensed that my words to him, I believed God used and had greater influence because of my submission to his authority. And some of those things are very subtle, and they're a matter of the spirit and the heart as well as the actions. But I began to discover God blessing in those circumstances. And I didn't ever really find a case in that experience where I had to say, I just simply won't do this. I've never had to make that hard choice, I felt, in those circumstances. Now, I'm now in a situation where I think I'm having to make some of those choices in the area of, just privately, in the area of, I have authority to marry people, of course, handle domestic relations, and I think I'm having to go a little different road than maybe some others, and I feel inclined to do that. And even so, though, I need to appeal to those above me and explain why I wish to do it differently in my judgment. Now, someone else may have an answer or some input on this. Certainly not limited or think I have all the wisdom, because I don't. Or another comment.
I like to touch which is the way which brings it down to a problem.
Uh-huh.
The problem or my trouble is to agree with your judgment and knowing of the way the judges and the law hands cases of young people rather than putting them to punish, you know, at this time. I think it seems to me it's so lenient that we have a problem of straightening these youngsters out if you let them go too far. Now, it's very difficult to say, the judges set down the law, it's too lenient. Is it to say that we probably should look on and be more giving, or how do you? I know this, that we do not have the prisons to handle the boys' rights as well.
Yeah.
How do you? There's another side of it which I'm sure I can see. How does the judge feel?
Well, I'd be glad to discuss particulars with you, since I was involved for 21 months with that, and saw about 3,000 or 4,000 families and youth and their families in that time. But I would encourage a person who's looking on from the community to possibly go to the court, go to that judge or others in the court, and try to discuss openly what's going on and express interest and appeal. You see, I discovered that practically no one ever, very few people ever came to me. It might be someone I actually knew out here, a few people share their viewpoint. But judges, for instance, are very isolated. Most judges, if approached without being openly hostile to them, but with genuine concern, you can appeal to them, even as Daniel appealed here. And I think probably citizens very little exercise their right to appeal to authority. Someone that's really interested and come forth and wants to discuss the nitty-gritty issues and is gentlemanly about it, is going to be well received 99% of the time, even by the non-Christian judge. And probably he will be of more influence than he realizes. More influence than he realizes. So first of all, I'd say that. Secondly, in usual circumstance, the judge has to operate under some laws passed by a legislature. And so there's much influence can be done by appealing to those, and usually for most of us, there's one or two people that we can really appeal to, but appeal to those who are involved in representing us in affecting that law. And again, we try to gather information ourselves. We try to learn as much as we can about it. So it does involve some real input, aside from the prayer and all that kind of situation. It's a very involved thing, and I have a lot of thoughts on your specific question about what to do, and I'd be glad to talk with you a little bit afterwards if you like. And I'm not trying to avoid that, but I'd get off on a speech if I went on that. And I want to give opportunity to hear some more questions and thoughts, too.
Mm-hmm. I think John and I probably have more of the similar ideas when we came in here. And I'd like to hear a little bit pursued about some of the things he asked. Do you see... or how do you see it as an observer who is involved in it? the plea bargaining and things that he's talking about, like, you know, you almost got to go along with the system for expediency's sake. Maybe you try to justify the end that's clear out there. How involved is that? Is there anything that we as citizens can do to help in all those areas?
Well, plea bargaining, as I understand that term to mean, is simply the exchange of between the prosecuting authority or attorney and the defense attorney representing the defendant, usually, to determine if there is some possibly lesser included charge that a person would plea to, as opposed to going to trial on the higher charge, which may involve a recommendation or not as far as incarceration and punishment. On that kind of a thing, I think you have to start with the premise of determining whether you believe. See, the interesting thing is whether you believe that this is the law and this ought to be the consequence, and it ought to apply to every time that law is broken exactly the same, or whether the law ought to be applied depending somewhat on where the individual is coming from, the extent of the crime. You know, there can be a burglary where $15 is taken. There can be a burglary where it's a person who's involved in a large number of crimes, possibly with a ring and lots is taken. It can be a heinous, forceful crime, or it can be a much less heinous. Or should there be judges and a procedure by which those kind of considerations are had? Or should we have it almost like a computer, where this crime is committed and you put in the crime on one side, the person or individual who's committed in the middle here, and the result out here, and it just happens? You know, that gets down to the nitty-gritty issue. And the plea bargaining is probably, in my experience of it, and I don't know what your experience is, and I'm not in Oklahoma, and I don't know what you may have specific reference to, but in my experience, I don't think is usually misused or has those many consequences. One of the realities of life, we don't have perfect wisdom like God does to even persuade others or prove that someone's violated the law. Sometimes the evidence is very weak, what you can actually bring into court and prove about a given incident. Now, in the newspaper and all, it may look very clear sometimes. And I'm sure at times the courts or the procedure can be misused and is, but far more than not, I think, and I'd be glad to have someone come and visit as often as they want and talk about specific cases in my personal situation. I think that's open to public view. I think more times than not, when you take all these variables, ability to prove, individual and that person's own personal involvement in the crime and all his personal characteristics, and there needs to be some flexibility. And plea bargaining represents part of that picture. And also you soon discover it's easy to say, well, we'll just put this person in the penitentiary or someplace like this. But ultimately, you have to decide what is best for that person and society both. And penitentiaries don't rehabilitate. Anyone that thinks that's their purpose is simply not true. And they probably don't even inhibit very much people from committing crimes when it gets right down to it, as an actual fact. I'm not saying it is. I'm only pointing out that it doesn't usually do that. And if there are other means by which, in a given individual's case, there is a reasonable possibility that that person can be rehabilitated so that, you know, he has to pay a consequence. I think there needs to be consequences. There are consequences of simply being convicted, period. You probably may not appreciate how many consequences that works in a person's life. And so I'm not one that thinks every person ought to go to the penitentiary, is what I'm saying. And there are... Now, the truth of the matter is, crime is so great, there are so many, and resources are so few, that the system, you know, part of the judgment of God, I think, on our land is that the system is overwhelmed and trying to deal with.